Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold. All cases are still holding here. We're at episode 53 this time, March 5th, if you're listening on the earliest day possible, which of course we know that you are, for the March 6th issue of JBJS. Per the usual, all the comments that you will hear, all the exciting input on the research that we're going to discuss are the opinions of myself and my colleague. They are not the opinions of the editor-in-chief or the editors of the other JBJS family of journals or the opinions of the board of directors. Some of the takes are hot, intentionally so. We want to get an exciting discussion going, get the creative juices boiling. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt, read it for yourself, see what you think. That's what we're trying to do here. Get more exciting information out on research in the orthopedic space. This episode of Your Cases on Hold is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. Sign up if you need to. The spots are filling up and things are going to get popping in May. So use the impetus of this to get signed up for that program if you haven't already. It really is an invaluable contribution to your orthopedic education, regardless of where you are in your career. I'll take the Pepsi challenge with that. With that, I am Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor for Methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. And across the way, I have
Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor of Adult Reconstruction, also at JBJS.
And keep in mind, everyone, that we cannot be running these deals every week. We are actually running low on our inventory of Dr. Antonia Chen action figures. So
they are not popular for some strange reason. I don't know why. All they do is hips and knees. It's pretty boring, but I love them.
The extra Ronger grip.
Look, we are looking for ergonomically sized ones, but we'll leave it at that. Go for it.
Let's step into the top of the pile. We'll step into the pile here, right? How about that?
Sounds good. But at the top.
We have What's Important from Student to Doctor by Richardson. This is permanently free. So anytime you hear me talking about this, you can check that out. Sagittal Alignment in the Degenerative Lumbar Spine, Surgical Planning by Debo and colleagues, our neighbors to the south at Brown School of Medicine. Racial, Ethnic, and Gender Diversity of Orthopedic Journal Editorial Boards by Pujari and colleagues. And then we have How Research Improves Clinical Care, The Case for Orthopedic Surgeon Research Leadership and Collaboration. This is an AOA Critical Issues Symposium by Chu and colleagues. And then Informed Consent in Orthopedic Surgery, a primer by Hirschfeld. There's a lot in the pile in this episode. We're not done yet, but wait, there's more. Establishing Orthopedic Standards of Care for Incarcerated Patients, Ethical Challenges and Policy Considerations by peers and colleagues. That's permanently free. And then Increasing Burden of Lower Extremity Fractures in the Middle East and North Africa, the MENA region, a 30-year epidemiological analysis by Hovedai and colleagues. So that's what's in the pile. Now we'll move into the headlines. In the headlines this week, I will be presenting lower opioid prescription quantity does not negatively impact pain control or patient satisfaction after ACL reconstruction, a randomized prospective trial by Johns et al. And there is a visual summary for this. This study is a well-conducted level one randomized controlled trial looking at different issue of oxycodone following ACL reconstruction. The patients were randomized into three prescription groups, 15, 25, or 35 tablets of 5 milligram oxycodone. And it was 180 patients were included. Ultimately, in the analysis, they were looking at VAS pain scores, IMDC scores, the morphine milligram equivalents that were used or consumed, which was patient reported, and patient satisfaction with regard to pain control between the treatment groups. Overall, as I think we're seeing in a lot of studies like this, the signal has been pretty consistent. The prescription of the 15 opioid tablets actually resulted in equivalent pain control, satisfaction, short-term functional outcomes as the larger prescriptions. So lower is always better, both to minimize the risk of sustained prescription use and then also to limit the potential for leftover medications that are unused to get into the community. Overall, the 15-tablet cohort felt that they received the right amount, or even some of them characterized this 15 as too many, which I thought was interesting. Now, you know, we'll keep in mind it is ACL, and that's not total knee replacement, obviously. It's not spine surgery, like a lumbar fusion. So this may not necessarily extend beyond the sports medicine space, but I think ACL is probably what we could consider a representative or characteristic procedure for the sports medicine community. I think that's ultimately in the eyes of the provider. And I don't do ACLs or rotator cuff, but there's some shared similarities. And if you even consider that, it's a higher intensity surgery in terms of drilling the tunnels and things like that than doing like a meniscectomy. So you know, that would be like a step down even.
So right. I think you would think it'd be more. So it's pretty good that the 15 right. is not too bad.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. If it's 15 for the ACL, it should be less for just, you know, than, you know, simple arthroscopy or meniscectomy or something to that effect. They do recognize, and they did make some secondary comparisons, particularly based on graft selection, which they really weren't powered to do. And they do recognize that and the limitations. But I would caution any kind of investment on that front. I would say just, you know, and this is kind of me recognizably probing for, you know, possible other explanations, two things. One, and this came to mind because I'm reading a separate study about a randomized controlled trial on smoking cessation in orthopedic trauma patients. So they asked patients, you know, do you want to participate? And then they found that like all their interventions for smoking weren't significant because the group that received nothing had like super high quit rates. So the control group like outperformed everything else, which they surmised. And I think this could be at play here, has to do with, you know, they asked people, do you want to be in a study that's going to randomize you to opioid medications? Ostensibly, if they read the literature that was given to them, it had something around, we're trying to reduce opioids in the community. So it may be people who are already concerned somewhat about their opioid medication use. You know, someone who is very fixated in a counterfactual on, they want to make sure they get the most opioids at the end of the surgery, they're probably not signing up for your randomized trial, right? They're going to say, no, I'm very concerned about my pain. I want to make sure that I have an appropriate amount and I don't want to be at risk of having less than. So they're not going to participate in this. So these may be people who are already motivated to not use opioids or to try to get the best pain control they could get without involving opioids. And then there's also the Hawthorne effect, meaning that when you know you're being observed for something, it's going to make you extra conscious about what you're doing. And that could also be at play here. They knew that they were going to have to report how much they were using. So they were really focused and thinking about how much they had to take and were they really needing to take it? Or so, I mean, those are not necessarily critiques. They in any kind of study like this, I think that those kind of questions may come into play, as we already saw in that corollary that I drew from the study around smoking cessation after orthopedic trauma. But I think this was well done. I think it's presenting a signal that we are seeing around these sports type procedures. Dr. Elizabeth Matskin, one of our colleagues, had published a study a few years ago in arthroscopy that had kind of a similar signal. So I definitely think there's some reality there. And this provides a very useful benchmark of that 15 tablets that you can, you know, put your hand on and support your clinical work going forward.
I will say, for people who are listening and ask for more sports medicine, this is a sports medicine article, so you're welcome. We do have a little bit of spine total joint bent, which I am definitely guilty of. So here's a little bit of ACL work, so I appreciate that. This is echoing some of the work that some of our hand colleagues did in JBJS previously, looking at the number of opioids used for things like carpal tunnel or rotator cuff repairs, things like that. So it is really good to keep adding these algorithms to the system. And I think the really key thing is assuring paper, like, it's okay. You don't need that. You don't need as many opioids as you think you need. But there is a lot of biases that you brought up there. So I'm curious what this would be like if it were a real world effect as a viewing patients, as opposed to, we're studying this, we're going to know how many pills that you're going to be taking.
People are reaching out to you about not enough sports in JBJS, or they want us to cover more sports. We can only cover what they print. We can only cover what's published. So.
I love it. Well, we put it out there, guys. So thanks for listening. If you're one of our sports nerds too, because I'm a joints nerd and I admit it.
All right. Well, so the article that you selected for your headline is also kind of not in the joints nerd space, certainly. Yeah. Outcome following intramedullary narrowing of tibial diaphyseal fractures, suprapatellar nail insertion results in superior radiographic parameters, but no difference in midterm function by Makaram and colleagues. There's a commentary and an infographic.
I love it. So I went the trauma route here. When I was a resident, infrapatella was all the way to go. And during my residency, we started switching to suprapatella. It was all the rage at the time. So I feel nice that when they wrote this article, they said it's a more recent approach. Makes me feel more recent, but I know I'm not. So it's one of those things where we looked at this study, and it's nice to see that they were comparing suprapatella or infrapatella. It is an age-old debate. And the proposed benefits of the suprapatella approach include the semi-extended position of the knee. Ideally, you can reduce the deforming forces acting on the proximal fracture fragments, and potentially you can reduce the fracture better, potentially get better fluoroscopic access because you're not fully flexed, you're in a semi-extended position, potentially avoid repeated malposition, and watch out though for traumatizing the patella. The main purpose of the study was to compare mostly radiographic parameters, and they talked about two different parameters. And it was the nail insertion point accuracy and fracture malalignment. And the secondary purpose was to compare outcomes and patient-reported outcomes. It was a level one trauma center from 2017 to 2020, looking at acute diaphyseal fractures, OTA, AO classification 42, that were treated with reamed and locked intramedullary nails. The key factor here, though, it is not a randomized control study. They are looking and comparing suprapatella with infrapatellar nails, but it was basically based on surgeon choice. I bet you a lot of times it really depends on pump comfort level, how many cases they did of that certain type of nail, if they were trained in suprapatella versus infrapatella. So it wasn't a randomized study looking at these patients. You also don't know if a surgeon chose a certain approach because of the fracture pattern that was present. So that's something to think about as well, too. The fracture location was looking at diaphyseal fractures, and they looked at this Mueller's rule of squares, such as the proximal and distal boundaries of the metaphysis were defined by a square whose sides were the same length as the width of the respective articular surface. Thus, the area between these squares were considered a diaphysis. Anything that was articular, so including the joint surface, or periarticular, were not available for inclusion into the study. For the suprapatellar approach, they did this without the use of mechanical traction with the bone foam and the knee in semi-extended position. And the infrapatellar was performed with traction or with the use of a radiolucent triangle with the knee flexed. So this specific parameter, the nail insertion point accuracy, is based on the insertion point of the intramedullary nail. In previous study, the most commonly reported optimal location was described as a 23-millimeter wide zone centered 9 millimeters lateral to the midline of the tibial plateau. So next time you're looking at that fluoro image, pull out your little ruler there and look for that 9 millimeter difference there. How do they define malalignment? It depended on where the location of the fracture was. They broke it down into the distal third, proximal third, and mid-shaft fractures, and they looked at different angles. So it included the lateral distal tibial angle, the anterior distal tibial angle, the medial proximal tibial angle, the posterior proximal tibial angle, and they wanted to look at a threshold of greater 5 degrees off of the axis as malalignment for the mid-shaft fractures. They also looked at union, so there was malunion in either plane, both coronal and sagittal, and it was defined as greater than 5 degrees of angulation on AP or lateral x-rays, accompanied by a callus bridging of at least three of four cortices. Fracture union was, again, the callus bridging, and there's no symptoms of non-union, and the non-union was no clinical or radiographic signs of healing. The patient-reported outcomes that were used were the Leishholm knee score, the Oxford knee score, and overall satisfaction score. Based on looking at all these patients, they got down to 211 patients. So it wasn't a huge study patient population. They did note that almost 7% of the fractures were in the proximal third, 41% were in the middle third, and the majority, 52%, were in the distal third. There were no demographic or injury characteristic differences between groups, and they did show that they had good intra-rater reliability when looking at all these different angles and measurements, including the NIPA, malrotation, and non-union versus union. So the take-home message is suprapatellar nailing was associated with superior or better NIPA and a reduced standard deviation of the mean NIP compared with infrapatellar nailing. for both the coronal and sagittal planes. There was also significantly reduced rates, now significant being statistically significant, of coronal malalignment and overall malalignment. Now, the difference, as I said, were actually, while statistically significant, the difference was 0% for suprapatellar and almost 8% for infrapatellar. So that's a pretty good spread with regards to percentage. They did a regression analysis and found that nailing approach was the only variable significantly associated with NIPA in both the coronal and sagittal planes and with malalignment. That said, malunion and nonunion were pretty similar between patient populations, and patient-reported outcomes were only available for 56% of the patients, so it's just above the majority of patients. There was no difference in the Leishholm knee score, the Oxford knee score, and overall satisfaction. There's also no difference in the pain component specifically of the Leishholm knee score. And in binomial regression, adjusting for confounding factors, the only variables associated with an unsatisfactory or like a low OKS or Oxford knee score and the Leishholm knee score were open fracture and more severe ASA grade. The fracture location, proximal, middle, or distal, had no influence on the functional outcome. So the take-home message is that while we look at this NIPA, so we spend a lot of time finding the ideal start point. We kind of treat it like a proximal femoral nailing. Say, once you got a good start point, you're good to go. While the suprapatellar approach was associated with superior accuracy of the nail insertion point and reduced rates of malalignment, there was really no clinical differences in outcomes, such as malunion, functional outcomes, in the time frame of the study. So you may not need to kill yourself for the perfect start point. You don't need to measure 9 millimeter off the tibial spine with a 23 millimeter range. So the start point may not be as important as we want. And I guess they'd say, take the nailing that feels most comfortable to you.
Yeah, I think that's like probably the most salient and clinically relevant take-home message that comes out of this effort. Yeah, overall, well done. So far, 2 for 2. And if you guys are wondering why this episode is entitled Andrew and Antonia Cover a Sports Article, now the secret is revealed. It's no longer a mystery.
Antonia and Andrew cover a non-spine, non-joints articles until right now.
I mean, I don't keep track of what we cover, but there are not enough spine articles that like we're always covering a spine article. I mean, joints, of course.
We have a lot, but variety is the spice of life.
Yeah, there you go. All right. So is this case going on hold? The Your Case is on Hold featurette, development and validation of a deep learning model to predict total hip replacement on radiographs. The total hip replacement prediction, abbreviated THREP model, by Xu and colleagues, and there is a commentary, so you don't have to take our word for it. Before I go into this, I just want to take an opinion poll from the only person here who can give an opinion. How necessary is machine learning models to predict total hip replacement?
So the interesting thing I will say after reading this is that patients a lot of times do ask, when do you think I need to undergo a hip replacement? So it's surprisingly more relevant than I anticipate based on what we see in the clinic. But as I'm sure you're about to delve into, a lot of it depends on more than just the radiograph.
Yeah. I mean, patients ask me all the time, like, when am I going to need spine surgery? How am I going to know that I need spine surgery, right? I mean, it's the same question. So the concept is a cool concept, right? That, like, we're going to develop a model that's going to predict the future. I mean, who doesn't want to predict the future? That's what we're talking about here, right? This is everything that machine learning and its proponents are trying to sell you. They're there at the carnival and they're going to guess your weight. They're going to guess when you need a total hip replacement, but not so fast, my friends, not so fast. They ignore the man behind the green curtain because there's always a man behind the green curtain.
Entrance into Oz.
Yeah. So what this study did is it took records from the Osteoarthritis Initiative, an NIH-initiated longitudinal multicenter observational study on osteoarthritis, which has like close to 5,000 participants across a 9-year span. And they went and found the patients who actually did undergo a total hip arthroplasty, of which, as in many of these studies, you imagine like it's going to be like overflowing with total hip patients, but actually there weren't that many of them. There were 185. And then they did a match. They matched these patients based on age, sex, body mass index, and ethnicity. And the first thing I'm asking myself is like, why did they have to do a match? They could have just kind of gone off of the 185 index cases, and then they'd have like 3,000 plus non-operated patients. And that's just way more data to pull from. But what they ultimately did was match the patients, which, yeah, there's not anything inherently wrong with it. You're just reducing the numbers on which you're going to ultimately develop, you know, these models. So they used imaging and clinical symptom data were passed through a detection model and then a deep convolutional neural network, that's machine learning. They divvied them up into the training, validation, and testing cohorts. This is, you know, data collected from a third party. It is multi-center. So, you know, across the board, there are no reservations there. Ultimately, they had 184 cases and 552 controls. And then, you know, the machine learning does its thing. And it basically now you put in some details, you give it some figures, and it's going to give you a prediction. They asked to develop a couple of things, the 0 to 2 years, the 3 to 5 year, and the 6 to 9 year predictions in terms of who needs a total joint. I think it's interesting, though, when you get into the weeds on this and you look at their table one, you know, here they have the age, BMI, racial categories, which are white, black, Asian, and other non-white, and then presumably the biologic sex. And then they have persistent clinical symptoms, yes, no, and then the KL grade. That's pretty much all they're working off of, or at least that, you know, we're presented with. The model performs reasonably well. The problem, as they recognize, is that they don't really know what the neural network is leveraging to make its prediction. And there's going to be a lot of interactions there, right, between the symptomatology. And I think it's very, you know, what are persistent clinical symptoms? There can be persistent clinical symptoms that are low grade. There can be very severe symptoms that have only developed recently. Are those persistent? Are they not? Like, there's a lot of semantics there. And again, they don't know, and you don't know, and I don't know, and anyone who's applying this doesn't know that if you put in these figures, it can't tell you, like, well, this determination is made off of the assessment of the KL grade plus the racial category. You're missing a lot of racial categories here, too. You're missing a lot of ethnicity-based categories as well. There's no Hispanic, for example. Other non-white is going to be a very heterogeneous, non-applicable group. But you can't ignore that in the model. The model is going to give you something that accounts for that. You have to be sort of shoehorned into those racial demographic groups, what have you. I just think that the sample size would need to be considerably larger to really leverage the power of machine learning in this context. And I think you need more clinical information. So it's nice what they presented. They do recognize in the conclusion, and this is reading from them, increasing the size of the data set, enhancing the ethnic and socioeconomic diversity of the participants, and improving the follow-up rate would improve the quality of the conclusions. A little bit of a paraphrase on the end. And I promise you, I came up with all my critiques before I read that, but it is really well aligned with everything I just told you.
I will concur with you.
I just don't, there's so much that goes into a decision for surgery. And if you have a patient who says, I'm never having surgery, there's just no way I'm having it, then this will always be wrong, right? And right. If you have someone who says, no matter what you tell me, I want to have surgery, then
we're going to do a surgery.
Around when they're going to have the surgery might, you know, be off. I think, you know, first off, these kinds of studies are fun and they appeal to why many of us went into research in the first place. But at the same time, like the clinical utility, you know, if you're telling a patient, well, yeah, in 8 years, you're going to need a hip replacement. And they're like, yeah, 2 years later, they're just, I can't live with this anymore. You're not going to be like, well, no, the model says you're not ready for one until 8 years. Like, if they have the severity of the arthritis and they have the objective clinical findings and they're ready for surgery, then they're going to be ready for surgery.
So it's not a stop, collaborate, and listen?
No vanilla ice feature on this.
Too bad. It was a good try.
Yeah. Kudos to you for, you know, dropping that hit from 33 years ago. let's move
on to the
honorable mentions. We have incidence and clinical characteristics of slip capital femoral epiphysis in patients with endocrinopathy, a population-based cohort study by Huang and colleagues. This is 30 days free. And this is looking at slip capital femoral epiphysis. It's using the nationwide database in South Korea, 2002 to 2019, ultimately concluding that the incidence was approximately four times higher in children with endocrinopathy than in those without. So I think that's something that certainly has been postulated, but shown here with some more robust clinical evidence around it. Then we have congruent concavity restoration of the reconstructed glenoid after the Lattergé procedure, compensation for the position of the graft by Doe and colleagues. There's a commentary. It's also 30 days free. And there's an infographic for the trifecta. This is 31 patients retrospectively reviewed who underwent immediate postoperative CT scanning followed by CTA 6 months postoperatively. Ultimately, they found fibrous tissue formation plus remodeling of the transferred graft resulted in restoration of congruent concavity after a Lattergé procedure by compensating for initially non-flush positioning. So, you know, particularly interesting findings for this community. And, you know, perfection is the enemy of the good in some respects. That may be at play here. It is level four evidence, so do take that under advisement. And then finally, we have tandem reconstruction of the femoral diaphysis using an intercalary prosthesis and a fibular free flap by Shahzad and colleagues. This looked at a prospectively maintained database, reviewed retrospectively, though, comparing patients who had the reconstruction of oncological intercalary femoral defect using prosthesis and an inline fibular free flap. And they compared that with patients who underwent reconstruction using intercalary allograft. So their bioprosthetic femoral reconstruction with metal prosthesis and the flap resulted in earlier weight bearing, shorter time to union, fewer operations, and lower complication profile than the other type of reconstruction. This is a really small series, 24 patients, mean follow-up 5.3 years and 8.5 years respectively in the two groups. So, you know, that is valuable in a procedure that's rare and difficult to assemble numbers of the size where you can do more robust testing. That wraps it up. I can't believe that this episode is over, but it has come to an end. We always have fun here. Hopefully you had fun as well. Again, you know, take the comments with a grain of salt, read the articles for yourself, decide what you're going to apply and how you're going to invest in the work. If you like what you heard here, come back next week, get the old issues, like and subscribe, give us a 5-star rating, all of those, apply those on all the fronts. That really helps us out. If you didn't like what we had to say, hey, we covered a sports medicine article. You should give us some love for that. But if you didn't, you know, pop in next time. Antonia will be leading things and maybe probably will be better.
We'll just have a good time. Thanks for listening.
We're out of time. Hopefully we'll do better next time. Your case is still on hold though.